From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, state lawmakers want to reform No Fault. If they pass a bill, they want to make sure voters can't challenge it. How? By attaching an appropriation.
Using this appropriation loophole is not the right thing to do. Sends the wrong message, makes people mad as hell.
Plus, bird flu has led to culling millions of birds in the Midwest. What's in store for Michigan's bird industry?
It's probably not a matter of if, but when this disease will impact Michigan.
Did you know when the governor leaves Michigan, he leaves his powers behind? Someone else steps in? So why is Lansing reluctant to tell us that?
Folks in the governor's office, the lieutenant governor's office, the secretary of state, the attorney general, none of them want to talk about it.
But we will today on Stateside. Some state lawmakers want to reform auto no-fault insurance, and they're making sure if the legislation passes, voters cannot challenge it. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, a veteran lawmaker weighs in on the appropriation loophole. But first, will state lawmakers forego their summer recess in order to come up with a new deal to fix Michigan's roads? Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta are co-hosts of It's Just Politics. They are here now. Hello, you two.
Hello, Cindy.
Hello.
Rick, lawmakers say they'll work through the summer. What's really going on here?
What's going on here is that the first thing that the legislature has to do as they try to once again try and resolve this whole question of how to raise $1 billion+ for roads is assure the public that they're making a sincere effort to doing that. So in the Senate, we saw this proclamation that they're going to work through the summer if necessary to get this done. No summer break until there is a road funding resolution. In the House, they haven't gone quite that far and said that we're going to give up our summer break, or as it is euphemistically known here in Lansing, the in-district work period.
Although Rick and I have been joking so much that maybe these lawmakers want to stay in Lansing. Voters are so angry right now. Maybe they don't want to go back to district. They're like, please, actually, let
us be in
Lansing. Stay here in the nice chambers where
far from voters.
But and what the House has done, they have created a special committee on transportation and road funding. Mm-hmm. And both of these, this is basically a goal regarding optics, trying to reassure the public that the legislature is, in fact, serious in the wake of the disaster that was Proposal 1 put on the ballot by the legislature.
Because let's be very clear, having to leave without a roads proposal
would look bad.
And, it's optics,
you know,
but
we're not off to a great start. You know, House Speaker Kevin Cotter rolled out his plan, no new revenue, that it would be redirecting from other sources, dedicated funds, and it was pretty widely panned.
Oh, the even conservative editorial page at the Detroit News going, this is fantasy.
Everybody
who is not a state House Republican said that this is, you know, this
everyone
is not
who
a
has
workable
plane
solution.
Tickets to a vacation over the, you know, over their summer break.
But lest we, the voting public, think, yes, they're in there in chamber day after day after day working on roads. Yeah. It's not how it works.
It's absolutely not how it works. The nitty gritty negotiations doesn't happen with all 100, you know, plus.
It doesn't happen on the floor of the State House of Representatives.
Exactly.
It doesn't happen on the floor of the State Senate. It happens in work groups where interested parties get together and say, this might work. This is acceptable. This is not acceptable.
Running back and forth with the governor going, hey, you know, is this something you could sign? So this is happening, you know, within a small group of folks. This is not all the lawmakers together.
So when we hear Majority Floor Leader, State Senator Mike Cowell saying, if we have to work right through till September, so be it.
Right.
Might more of that be committees are working and everybody's kind of hanging out looking busy?
It's the optics.
Well, that's exactly how these things work. I mean, you know, you go back to the mid-1990s in Proposal A when we were completely revamping our school funding system. And, you know, this happened as the legislature was approaching its winter break. Mm-hmm. People were hanging out, that they were finding out how long the breaks were. They were, you know, dashing out of the Capitol to do their Christmas shopping. That, you know, the critical element here that will matter for the legislature to be here through the summer is if there is something for 110 members of the State House of Representatives 38 members of the state Senate mm-hmm. to vote on.
Mm-hmm. Well, what makes them think that this time is going to be any different from the last how many years? Three or four years?
That is the billion-dollar plus.
They couldn't pull it together.
That is the billion-dollar plus decision, right? That now they're going, no, we're going to get it done this summer. You know, even Cotter going, hey, you know, we could even maybe get it done in the end of June, in which case we wouldn't have to then stay through the summer. I mean, this idea, and this is what Rick and I have been talking about, too. What, you know, because over the past 3 or 4 years, things didn't work. Now is the moment. I mean, what we see with these legislators is it comes down to sort of momentum and timing. The only reason we saw Prop 1 was because it was at the very end of lame duck. They were all exhausted. The session was about to be done.
Staggered across the finish
line. They were ready to be done.
And Governor Snyder had set a deadline mm-hmm. and was not willing to let that deadline pass mm-hmm. without coming up with something. And so what they came up with was something that could clear the legislature.
Yeah.
But that didn't extend to actually, you know, winning the approval of the voting public. So one of the things we're seeing now is everyone is realigning the same pieces on the chessboard to see if they can come up with a different result. We saw the Bridge Magazine poll that says that business people are willing to accept some kind of a tax or a mm-hmm. fee hike in order mm-hmm. to pay for this. I mean, a lot of this is all about pushing legislative Republicans to accept revenue.
Yeah. And this goes back, though, to what we were all talking about last week, Cindy, though, mm-hmm. is that each lawmaker is going to take away what the result of Prop 1 was and use it to their advantage.
For spin.
So Senator Brandenburg, for example, who is so anti-new taxes, is going to say, this was a vote against new mm-hmm. taxes. Mm-hmm. And so this is where this dynamic of this idea that you're going to get it done in a month, I just don't see that happening because everyone is still coming at it going, Prop 1 were the results that I want to see.
And the defeat was so resounding that everyone sort of looked at it through their own prism.
Exactly.
And came away with that.
So why
conclusion?
Is the behavior going to change now? If anything, folks are even more, no, sticking to my guns, sticking to what I want to see, what I believe, because I believe the voters were saying, fill in the blank.
You know, last 30 seconds, jump ball. If September rolls around and there's no viable road funding proposal, then what? Zoe?
Oh, more angry people.
People continue to be angry.
Voters continue to be angry. Roads continue to crumble.
The question is then, do we go into the next year, an election year, with a public that is angry about, you know, the condition of the roads and mm-hmm. the fact that the legislature didn't act on it? You know, we thought we were going to see that in the last statewide election.
I was going to say, that's what we thought happened. Of the last election in 2014. So, you know, what goes around comes around and then comes around
or
again.
Doesn't.
Or doesn't. Touché.
And meantime, the potholes.
Yeah, maybe what I should have seen is we've seen this movie before. We know how it ends.
Yeah. Zoe Clark and
or
Rick.
Doesn't.
Or doesn't. In the meantime, Pothole Central.
Waiting for the sequel.
Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta are the hosts of It's Just Politics here on Michigan Radio. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks, Cindy.
You bet.
Did you know when the governor leaves Michigan, he gives up his power and authority and someone else is in charge? And if you assume that someone else is the lieutenant governor, think again. Dennis Lennox is a columnist for the Morning Sun paper in Mount Pleasant, and he recently wrote about what he calls Michigan's acting governor mystery. Welcome back, Dennis.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
You know, we're very accustomed to seeing the president of the United States zipping all over the world and he stays president, but not Michigan's governor?
No, you know, the president can stay president, but as soon as Governor Snyder, or frankly, for that matter, any governor, regardless of party, steps foot outside of Michigan, he or she is no longer governor. And it can create some awkward situations because sometimes it does go on for a few days at a time.
No, this is in the state constitution?
It is. There's a provision of the state constitution that says whenever a governor is absent from the state, somebody becomes acting governor. And, you know, it dates sort of way back to colonial times, because back in colonial times you had a royal governor and you had a lieutenant governor. And the royal governor was basically, it was a patronage appointment from the king, and the lieutenant governor, who was always a resident of the colony, was the day-to-day governor. And so we've kept lieutenant governors, and governors have always had that provision. When the governor's not around, the lieutenant governor's in charge.
But as you found out, the lieutenant governor is not always the one who's acting governor.
That's correct. In fact, we really don't know who is the acting governor, because it's sort of like a highly classified state secret. When you start asking questions around Lansing, it's not something that folks in the governor's office, the lieutenant governor's office, the secretary of state, the attorney general, none of them want to talk about it. And I don't think it's that big of a state secret. I think, if anything, it illustrates the need why this provision of the Constitution needs to be changed.
Interesting. In fact, you note in your column that when Governor Snyder was ringing the bell on Wall Street recently, Lieutenant Governor Kelly was in South America on a trade mission, so we actually had Secretary of State Ruth Johnson at the helm of the ship of state.
We did, and we don't know for certain whether Attorney General Bill Schuette has ever been acting governor. He's next in the line of succession, and then it goes down from there. There's even a scenario where former Lieutenant Governor Dick Postumus, the governor's senior advisor, could be governor.
Really? So it's all spelled out. We just keep going down the line till we get someone?
We do, essentially. There's a statute that requires the governor to designate people past the directly elected office holders, like the Secretary of State, the Lieutenant Governor, the Attorney General, the Speaker of the House. Once you kind of get past that, there's some weird scenarios that kick into place.
What's the weirdest scenario?
Well, the Dick Postumus, the director of the DEQ, the DNR, you know, that's like the worst case scenario. But again, this sort of illustrates the point that maybe it's time we revisit this provision of the Constitution in this day and age, whether Governor Snyder is in Toledo, Ohio, going into the Lost Peninsula. There's that little part of Monroe County that you can only get to by driving through Ohio, or whether he's in China on a trade mission. Modern technology makes it easy for him to stay governor.
And is there any kind of attraction towards having that discussion? Are you the first to kind of try to shed a little spotlight on this?
You know, I really couldn't find anybody else writing about this and talking about it. Again, a lot of the folks in Lansing didn't want to talk about it. The few folks that knew about it, it was like it was a highly classified state secret. Some of the legislators that I talked to, honestly, they weren't fully aware of how often this happens. It's not as if there's a press release put out every time the acting governor is in charge.
Very interesting, shedding light on Michigan's acting governor mystery. And one might think the public deserves to know who is in charge of the state and when.
I wouldn't say deserve. I think it's a basic expectation of government. I mean, after all, it is our government. We should know who's calling the shots, whether it's rubber stamping things or, God forbid, something more serious happens and the acting governor actually has to do something.
Dennis Lennox is a political strategist, and his column is in The Morning Sun, Michigan's acting governor mystery. Thanks so much, Dennis.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The poultry industry in the Midwest in Canada is on high alert these days thanks to a new strain of bird flu. This highly contagious virus has hit up to 33 million birds in 16 states at last report. So what about Michigan? Dr. James Averill is here. He's the State Veterinarian and Animal Industry Division Director. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Averill.
Thanks for having me.
We should perhaps begin this whole conversation by noting that this strain of bird flu in 2015 hasn't been shown to get people sick, right? Unlike that one from that came out of Asia a few years ago that did kill some people there?
Yeah, so there is no human cases at this time for people that are interacting with these affected flocks. And so we are very fortunate with that. And CDC and health departments are closely monitoring the highest risk people, and those are the people that are working in these poultry operations.
And we can't get it from poultry and eggs either, right?
No, and the lovely thing with avian influenza is it's not a food safety issue. However, I will stress, anytime you're dealing with eggs or poultry products, please cook it to 165 degrees Fahrenheit and thoroughly cook your eggs.
And that has nothing to do with this.
Nothing to do with avian influenza. That's food safety, good food safety practices in general.
So we are hearing stories out of Wisconsin and Minnesota and Iowa about millions and millions of birds being killed because of a few birds at these affected poultry operations testing positive for bird flu. Why do they all have to be euthanized?
Well, actually, this disease is actually killing the birds themselves. Mm-hmm. I mean, yes, they're testing and finding the disease in the flock, but this is actually killing the birds too. And so when we find it in a flock, we go in to depopulate, humanely euthanize all of those birds to reduce the risk of having further disease transmission in that area to another flock. And so this is a way of trying to control the disease and reduce the impact to other poultry producers.
Do we know how this bird flu is spread and where it came from, this strain?
Yeah, there's a lot of still unknown answers to a lot of questions at this point in time. What we do know is that, in general, avian influenza is a disease that is constantly circulating in our wild waterfowls. So the ducks and so forth can carry the disease, and it doesn't cause any illness to them.
Huh.
Periodically, though, what happens is that the disease then gets into our commercial or domestic poultry operations, whether that's someone that's raising millions of birds to someone that just maybe has five or six chickens in their backyard. And so that typically comes about either through direct interaction with those wild birds or indirect transmission where people have brought the disease, as an example, into the barn or facility, or it's come on a vehicle or something like that. And so at this point in time in this outbreak, which is very large, you know, I think we can say wild birds probably helped introduce it, but the number of farms we're seeing and the number of birds being impacted is because of some farm-to-farm transmission, where there have been breakdowns in biosecurity. And a theory that's being tested at this point in time is that maybe this influenza virus is being transmitted through the air in dust particles. It has been a very windy spring in the Midwest, and there has been some preliminary results saying that this virus can be suspended in the air through dust particles or maybe some feathers and being brought into the vent system in these farms.
Talking about this outbreak of bird flu in the Midwest and Canada with state veterinarian Dr. James Averill. So what about Michigan, Dr. Averill? Any cases reported?
So the good thing is here in Michigan at this time, there are no documented cases of avian influenza in Michigan. We are watching the situation very closely. We are prepared to respond in a timely and effective manner if the disease is found, and we're just trying to heighten everybody's awareness of the things they can be doing at themselves with their birds to protect them and be protecting Michigan.
And what kinds of biosecurity safeguards would that, what would it look like?
So some of the key things from a biosecurity standpoint are minimize traffic in and out of the facility, and minimize the number of people that are taking care of birds. So this is true whether you're a commercial producer or you're someone that's just in your backyard. Secondly, is don't be sharing equipment. Don't have your neighbor utilizing some of your old water pans or something like that, because the disease could be on it and so forth. Third is, when you introduce new birds to a flock, quarantine them for 28 to 30 days before introducing them with the rest of the flock. And then finally, try to, specifically those with backyard chickens and turkeys or whatever, poultry, try to keep them confined. Don't allow them to have interaction with free-ranging waterfowl or wild birds. And try to keep them confined. Or if you have to let them out, do it for a short period of time and then get them back in, as they could be exposed to the virus.
So those folks with the few outdoor chickens and turkeys in the yard, are they at more risk than the commercial operations? Because it's my understanding, and if I may be wrong, that the commercial operations keep their birds inside.
Yes, the backyard poultry folks are the ones that are probably at higher risk. However, at the same time, those birds are probably getting exposed to more things than those that are in the commercial population. They're like a bunch of newborn kids, and they're in a very clean environment, and all it takes is a little bit of a pathogen or a disease like avian influenza, a very small dose to get in there, and it could spread throughout that barn very quickly, where in some aspects the backyard birds maybe have a stronger immune system from that standpoint. And so they are at more risk in the backyard because of their potential to interact with the wildlife. But we have a very naive population in our commercial industry.
That's interesting. We're certainly talking about a lot at stake when you realize that Michigan's like 7th in the nation in egg production and 15th among turkey-producing states. That's a lot of money at stake.
Yeah, I mean, we are, you know, just think about here in Michigan, all the eggs that are produced in Michigan are used by McDonald's east of the Mississippi. And to lose that business revenue for our egg producers would be pretty detrimental if this disease came in and devastated their birds.
Are you confident that the biosecurity safeguards in place can keep that bird flu out of Michigan?
Biosecurity practices are never 100%, but they can help, and they can help mitigate the impact, the severity of the disease. However, they're not 100%, and we're really hoping what we're doing here and making everybody aware of the situation, what's going on out in the Midwest and happening, that people are aware and they're practicing good biosecurity practices and keeping the disease out. But at the same time, it's probably, I think, very safe to say it's probably not a matter of if, but when this disease will impact Michigan.
And when that happens, as you alluded to earlier, quick action would mean?
So quick action as in we would be quarantining that farm upon suspicion of avian influenza. No poultry products are to move on and off that. And then upon confirmation, we would be moving down the road of depopulating that flock of birds. So things get really crazy in the first 12 to 24 hours of just being suspicious of it and trying to take action and alert folks of what's going on so that we can try to reduce further disease transmission.
State veterinarian Dr. James Averill, thank you so much for talking with us, Dr. Averill.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Long, long before the days of CGI and Photoshop, some fascinating and complex photographs were taken to rally public morale during World War I. They were called living photographs. Thousands and thousands of soldiers exquisitely arranged and choreographed into formations, American emblems, patriotic symbols, even the face of President Wilson. One such living photograph was taken at Camp Custer near Battle Creek, the largest production with some 30,000 officers and men arranged into a human U.S. shield. Lewis Kaplan is here now to tell us more about these photos. He's a professor of history and theory of photography and new media at the University of Toronto and the author of American Exposures, Photography and Community in the 20th Century. Good to have you with us, Lewis.
Oh, it's great to be on the show with you.
Set the scene for us. Can you describe this human U.S. shield?
Well, yeah, it consists, first of all, of 30,000 people, mostly enlisted men, and all the troops that were stationed at Camp Custer. And it was taken in 1918. Yeah, it's an amazing image, but of course we're on radio here, so
sure.
I'll have to try to describe it. What Mole did was he...
First of all, tell us who did this. Who were the photographers who did this?
Oh, yes. Well, the photographers involved here. Arthur Mole was the photographer, and John Thomas was the choreographer. So Mole went up in a tower, usually self-built, about 70 or 80 feet off the ground, in order to get the proper bird's-eye aerial perspective, in order to have the shield come into the form that was necessary. Because on the ground, you would just have this mass of 30,000 troops, but you would have to shoot it from the exact perspective. And these images took a long time to make. Mole would have to be working with Thomas beforehand, sometimes the whole week, in order to set the stage and then know exactly where the troops would go to set up the right formation.
And that is mind-blowing to me when I think about how the formations were arranged, because the detailing is eye-popping, and they didn't have an app like Drill Book Next that helps band directors put their marching bands into those incredible formations like they do in 2015. So how did they get everybody arranged so perfectly?
How it worked was this. See, Mole would begin by tracing the desired image on the ground glass plate that was mounted on his view camera. Then, up in his tower, he would use a megaphone, body language, and a long pole with a white flag tied to the end of it in order to point to the more remote areas, because obviously, given this perspective, the bulk of the troops had to be stationed further away in the back end of the field.
Yeah.
And then he would position his helpers on the field below, and they would nail the necessary pattern to the ground using yards of tape and sometimes using lace edging. So that's how they prepared the way. And then Mole, given his experience, would be able to figure out the exact number of troops that he needed in each of these locations and where they should stand. So that's the sort of the setting up
yeah.
of it. And then on the day of the shoot, sometimes the troops had to stand many hours before the testing and assembling into the exactly right position to get the perspective just right. So there was some trial and error on the day of the shoot. And the key, of course, as we all know, was to get the shot where the lines of perspective would resolve themselves into these intelligible, as you say, mind-blowing images.
That is something else. And if you think about just what we take for granted, snap a picture, look at it digitally, go, no, that didn't work, do this.
Right.
None of that was there.
Yeah. Well, that's why they're called living photographs, right? I mean, the human bodies of these soldiers, they are the pixels. In a sense, that, you know, that are forming these images. And that's why we call them sometimes living formations as well.
And how were they used and who was paying for all of this, Lewis?
Ah, well, that's a very good question. Well, you know, they weren't paid because, after all, why? Well, let's go back to your particular interested image. I mean, why were all these soldiers there? Well, they were, in a sense, training. They were all in military training facilities, either getting ready to go off to serve in Europe during World War I, or then after. Mo also took some images in 1919 after the war was over, after the Allies won. They were in the process of demobilization. So, in a sense, these enlisted men in the service of our country doing a little extra service to help Mull out in order, as you say, to make these images that serve as rallying points for the troops and for the nation in the patriotic effort. Because let's not forget that in 1917, there were still a number of people in the country that did not support World War I. They were called isolationists, and they really were feeling, well, the United States is better off just staying neutral. So Mole's images, particularly in that period of 1917 and early 1918, were getting people into the right patriotic spirit to support the war effort.
And I'm interested on your thoughts of how these living photographs advanced modern photography and effects.
Mm. Yeah, well, that's interesting. They certainly advanced modern photography in the sense of the move towards the spectacular image. There is a German theorist who referred to these images, to the genre of images, as mass ornaments. And I think that's a very interesting idea. The idea being that you would take these groups of people and turn them in somehow beyond their own living selves into these aesthetic forms, that these beautiful aesthetic forms would also serve a symbolic function because, as you said, these images formed these symbolic icons like the American flag, like the Statue of Liberty, like Uncle Sam is a very funny one to see the goatee of Uncle Sam formed by thousands of troops. So it's a very unusual practice, but it did in a way advance this kind of idea of mass photography for an age of mass reproduction.
When you think of the history of photography, was this one of the first times that photographs were used specifically to move the needle of public opinion?
I don't know. I mean, you could say that there's been a kind of a propagandistic function in photography for a very long time. Right. I mean, you could think about in the 19th century, you know, certain images being staged or certain sort of composite images being formed. I mean, even, you know, Abraham Lincoln, the first really photographed photographer, said that the images taken by Matthew Brady were such good publicity for him that they helped him win the election because they showed him in a kind of a presidential manner. So you can say that photography has always been serving certain kinds of publicity and even propagandistic functions. But I think what happens with Mole is how it happens on a mass scale because of the amount of people that were used in order to make these kinds of mass statements of patriotic support.
I'm interested whether, Lewis, when it came time to rally public opinion again, and that would be for World War II, was that ever tried again, or were we kind of past that?
No. These images come back. There are other photographers later on, and I talk about this in my book. For instance, there's a photographer by the name of Eugene Goldbeck, who was a Texas-based photographer, and he made a number of rallying images of this sort in the 30s and 40s. In more recent times, you also see the kind of return to this idea in there are digital photographs that also play around now. But, of course, again, now they don't really need the people there in order to make insignia or to make pictures of leaders pixels or out of individual photographs. And the photographs you might know of, they're called photomosaics. The photographs,
yes,
of Robert Silvers is a more recent manifestation of this continuing tradition.
Well, there is certainly an emotional punch packed when you look at these and realize it's thousands and thousands of officers and men standing for probably was a very long day to get arranged into these living photographs. It was a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for sharing the background of these very, very fascinating living photographs.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And as I said, you're very lucky to be living in the state where the largest assembly of men for most photographs ever took place.
Lewis Kaplan, professor of history and theory of photography and new media at the University of Toronto. His book is American Exposures. Thank you, Lewis.
Okay, thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. State lawmakers are hitting the accelerator pedal in their effort to reform Michigan's no-fault insurance law, the law that provides all victims of catastrophic crashes with a lifetime of unlimited medical benefits. The overhaul would cap the price medical providers could charge for caring for crash victims, and it would limit the amount of money that would be paid to provide home health care. In return, we would all get around $100 savings in our auto insurance for 2 years. This package of bills overhauling no-fault zipped right through the Senate, and it's now before the House. And my next guest has some very deep concerns over a tactic lawmakers are using to ensure voters may not challenge this overhaul should it be signed into law. Former Congressman Joe Schwartz is here with us. He's also a physician and a former member of the state Senate. Welcome, Congressman.
Thanks very much, Cynthia. Nice to be here.
Well, we've got supporters who point to Michigan's high insurance rates and say it's among the highest in the nation. And then we have critics like doctors and crash victims who say this reform sells out people who could be left severely injured in an auto crash for only about $8 a month for 2 years of savings in auto insurance. What are your views?
Well, MCCA, the Catastrophic Claims Association, has been around since 1978. We're unique in that our level is higher than any state. No state even comes close. I think New Jersey goes to $250,000. Mm-hmm. But we're up now to, next year, $545,000.
So Michigan's the gold standard in this.
Well, it is the gold standard, but for good reasons. It's not without a good and honest reason. And physicians, not only myself, but other physicians to whom I've spoken, who over the years have done a lot of trauma care and have patients to this day who are being cared for by MCCA funds, say, whoa, you can't stop this. We are now able to save a lot of people who 35, 40 years ago you couldn't save. Yes, they end up being quadriplegic and paraplegic, or they end up with the long-term problems they have with closed head injuries. But nevertheless, we save their lives, and that is, in fact, what we should do. It's costly, and MCCA takes care of that cost over and above now the limit of $545,000 that the regular auto insurance will pay. MCCA is, interestingly enough, even though it's a statutory organization, mm-hmm, is a 501c3. It's a nonprofit that was set up. It has a board of directors appointed by the insurance commissioner. That board is from five different companies that write auto insurance, five of the biggest ones, like AAA and auto owners and Citizens and Farmers and State Farm. And I think over the years they've done an excellent job. There is now $18 billion sitting in the coffers of MCCA. One wonders, and I think not without reason, what's going to happen to that money if MCCA goes away. The legislature has an alternative, and I've looked, mm-hmm, at the alternative. It's not a horrible thing.
Mm-hmm.
They're thinking this through. But the problem is sometimes you have something that really works, yes, unique from other states, but works, and maybe we should think twice or three times or four times before we get rid of it. And the idea that Michigan's high auto insurance rates are somehow due in, I think, an inordinate amount to MCCA is not correct. Michigan's high auto insurance rates are due to Detroit. You know, other areas in the state as well.
Mm-hmm.
But if only 50% or fewer of the vehicles in Detroit are insured, those who have insurance, probably a minority of auto owners in Detroit, are paying an inordinately high rate. Mayor Duggan wants to do something about it. He's proposed
right,
a D insurance, Detroit insurance, where the level, instead of $545,000, I believe he's thought about $250,000 mm-hmm. coverage for people with these horrible injuries. I mean, people are thinking about it, and I give Mayor Duggan a lot of credit. But the danger is that the legislature, in its rush to do something about this, will somehow take MCCA away and replace it with something that in no way, shape, or form really is a replacement, is not good public policy. It's still got one house to go through before it passes, and I'm not sure, even if it gets to Governor Snyder's desk, that he would sign it. So it's something for us to think about.
It's something that we've seen now as this has been sped through the Senate and now it's before the House, is something that's been put into that bill, which is an appropriation, which in essence shuts out any citizens who might want to challenge it in the future.
Yeah, that's a little known caveat. It's constitutional that the legislature has used from time to time over the years, where if there is an appropriation of $2,500 or more in any bill, you cannot do a referendum on that bill. A citizen's referendum cannot be done.
And there's a point to that within the Constitution, isn't it?
Yeah, there's a point to it.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's supposed to be for not necessarily wolf hunting bills or the right to work
you don't,
bill.
No, you don't want people to try to – if the legislature has worked very, very hard mm-hmm. to come up with an appropriations bill, and it's been difficult, and there's been a lot of give and take.
Yeah.
And by golly, finally we have
something.
An appropriations bill, and it's the best we can do. But you have some dissidents out there mm-hmm. that say, "Oh no, we're gonna do a referendum on this. We don't like this appropriations bill." That particular little codicil was passed for that reason, that you can't have a referendum on everything.
Mm-hmm.
However, to stick a $2,500 appropriation for anything on a bill that may be somewhat controversial, to protect that bill from any sort of citizen referendum is not good public policy, and that's not what that particular caveat was meant to do in the first place.
In fact, we might remember that the emergency manager bill that passed in 2011 did not have an appropriation, and voters overturned it in 2012, and then the legislature rewrote that bill with that appropriation, zipped it right through a lame duck. So now there's nothing that people can do. And as we were saying, we've seen preemptive appropriations in bills about redistricting, about the wolf hunt and right to work. What is this saying, do you think, to the voters of Michigan? What are lawmakers who do this saying to voters?
I don't think they're trying to say anything that's offensive. Mm. I mean, I don't think they're saying, we're the legislature, leave us alone. We know all and you don't know anything.
But it could be seen to look
like that.
Oh, it
can
be.
It can be. I don't think that's their intent.
What do you think they're saying?
What they need to realize outside of Lansing, which is, you know, six square blocks surrounded by reality, that it doesn't look good when you do that. And you really sell yourself short when you do that. So using this appropriation loophole, shall we say,
yes.
is not the right thing to do. Sends the wrong message, makes people mad as hell, and you come up a loser, not a winner. So I don't think that particular, I'll say it, a codicil to mm-hmm. the Constitution and added to the bill as a codicil should be used except in instances where you've done the best you can do. This is a terribly important bill. It is, in fact, an appropriations bill. Let's please get it through.
Right. So what, if anything, can citizens who look at this, as you say, people can get mad as hell over this. What's to be done about this tactic?
Well, the only thing can be done about it is amend the Constitution. That particular part of the Constitution would have to be repealed. Now, quite frankly, that's not going to happen. So you know, what you do is you watch. If the legislature is using that tactic and you believe it is inappropriate that they're doing so, call them on it. Call them out. Say, you can't do that. It's unlikely that there'll be a referendum on this issue, but nevertheless, don't take that option away from the people. And that's what is being done every time you see a little appropriation mm-hmm. stuck on a bill that's not an appropriations bill.
Can I ask, would it be fair for a voter to wonder whether they're going to get an open-minded listen from a legislator when they are doing that, knowing exactly what's happening, which is shutting out voters from the right to challenge?
I think most legislators are willing to listen. I think the intentions of almost all legislators are good. They want to do the best they can. We are paying the price now for something called term limits, where you have a terribly inexperienced legislature, and we'll have, as long as we have term limits, especially in the House. It takes a long time to learn how the wheels of government turn. You're dealing with a $53, $54 billion total budget, and you have newbies doing it. And it's very, very difficult. It's difficult for them. I'm not criticizing them. Mm-hmm. It's difficult for them to be airdropped into that situation. In the day, which is easy for me to say in the day, but in the day, when we first came to the legislature, there were people in the legislature who could act as teachers.
Mentors,
to us. They could mentor us. They could say, here's what we need to do. Here's what we shouldn't do. And there were always those people there. Nobody stayed around for a real long time, which is the reason term limits were passed. I chaired the study group on term limits by a very national legislative group. What I found, and Michigan was a good example, the average stay in the Michigan House at that time, pre-term limits, was less than 7 years. And the average stay in the Michigan Senate, pre-term limits, was just slightly more than 7 years. So we passed term limits, by the way, funded by out-of-state money, a constitutional amendment that we truly didn't need. 23 states had term limits at one time. It's now down to 15. 8 have repealed.
Is there anything you're seeing in Michigan that would lead one to think that a repeal movement could take root and grow?
I think the only way it can be repealed is through the courts. The term limits has a certain appeal. They, you know, throw the bums out. They're not doing the job. New blood. We need new blood.
There's even talk of make it part-time.
That strikes a responsive chord. Mm. But I think it's unlikely that it would be done by referendum. I think it could be done through the courts saying you do not have the right constitutionally. I have the right to run for an office. And it makes no difference if I've served 3 terms in the House. I would like to run for another term. It is my constitutional right to do so. Ultimately, I think that's what will happen.
Ultimately.
Yeah, I define ultimately. I can't.
Then in the meantime, I wonder what your thoughts are with what this kind of climate does to people feeling engaged with their representatives and feeling like they are heard and that they have a voice, or does it lend people to go, they're going to do what they're going to do?
I think people feel that they're heard, and legislators try to hear. The legislators are not shutting themselves off, I don't think. By and large, every member of the legislature is a good person, or they wouldn't have run for office. It's hard to run for office now. You subject yourself to all kinds of abuse, and unfortunately, your family to all kinds of abuse as well. People say horrible things about you, again, usually funded by money that didn't come in from your district, from here and there and everywhere. So they do the best they can do. But what I'm saying is that experience counts. Would you be operated on by an inexperienced surgeon? No. Would you like to be defended in a serious court case by an inexperienced attorney? Would you like your home or your business designed by a terribly inexperienced architect? So why in the world do we tolerate a legislative body that spends $53 billion public dollars every year to be manned and womaned by people with not a lot of experience? And they would be the first people to admit they don't have that experience and that it's been difficult for them. And they'd be the first people to say, you know, I've been here now 6 years in the House, and I'm really kind of just starting to learn how it happens, and now I'm gone. It's not a good situation.
Former Congressman Joe Schwartz, also former state senator and physician. It's always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Cynthia, thanks very much. Nice to be with you.
This is Stateside from Michigan Radio.
This is Julia Child. Bon appetit.
Nom, 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 nom.
Love that. Delicious. There's much attention being paid these days to Mexico, thanks to the DIA's retrospective on Frida Kahlo and Diego Rivera. And that has Chris Cook mulling over the Mexican concept of melanchismo. Chris is our Detroit magazine's chief wine and restaurant critic. And this is not a word most of us have heard before. What is it?
You may not have heard it, but once I explain it, you'll know what it's about.
All right.
Melanchismo is a word that's been used in Mexico, and I first heard it as associated with the auto industry when the auto industry in Detroit started opening plants down in Mexico, and these guys would come back and they'd say, oh, yeah, there's the Melanchismo thing. And they explained that basically Melanchismo is a belief south of the border that we cannot make anything as well as they can up there. It's sort of like a self-deprecation, a bit of an inferiority complex. Lots changed since those days. U.S. autos are no longer Melanchismo. We have very good cars now. And I think the same is true when you look at this wonderful exhibit that's in Detroit. It certainly doesn't reek of any Malanchismo.
Right.
But it's interesting because I travel a lot to the East Coast, and Malanchismo, I will say, doesn't exist there when it comes to Michigan wines. People look at Michigan wines and they really like them. I come back to Michigan, and people so often are just unbelieving that we can do anything well in this state. And it's quite common. I hear it more often than I like. It's not so much up in the wine country where the industry is so big, but elsewhere in the state, it happens. People say, are Michigan wines really good? And I have to start my spiel and say, yeah, they're really good. Not only that, our wines are rated so highly against the wines of California, of Washington, of Oregon. They beat those states out in competition all year long. Last year, we had 250-some gold medals out of competitions in the U.S. So we don't necessarily in the state pay the attention that I think we ought to pay to these wines and understand them.
As consumers and restaurant owners both?
Yeah, absolutely. Honestly, this is totally anecdotal, but I think I've seen more Michigan wine sections in wine lists in Chicago than I've seen around Detroit.
You know, it's interesting because we recently spoke on Stateside with Bill and Susan Bramer, and they own Laurentide Winery on the Lenoir Peninsula, and that was their big push for their essay for our next idea. Michigan, would you show some love to your own wines? Might even start, they suggested, by not having April as wine month in Michigan when it's muddy and cold and icky. How about a nice, bright, sunny July or August? But that idea of kind of a prophet unheeded in his own land.
Yeah, and I think that there's some signs of things beginning to happen now. And one of them is what I call the Mario Batali factor up north, which is really pumped right into the food and wine area. And there's the guy, I think his name is Oosterkamp, who just recently bought property with his wife, an actress named Amy Smart, and they just opened a winery. They're working with Batali on some things up there. Now, those are sort of the outsiders from the industry sort of going in there, and it's going to create a certain kind of a friction, but it's also their actions are an acknowledgement that East Coast and West Coast are seeing things here that we're not seeing here, a lot of people aren't seeing here, and that is the message that I'm trying to get to on this.
If we could shake off this Malanchismo about Michigan wines, what's the reward?
Oh, gosh. I mean, it's all there. I mean, you have great Michigan Rieslings. I mean, we even have Viognier being made now by a couple of wineries. It's just spectacular. And our red wines are coming along. My God, has anybody had a red wine in Michigan lately? Cabernet Franc are so similar that if you put them side by side in a lineup of Loire Valley red wines, you'd have a hard time identifying which was Michigan. And, you know, they just got such similarities. We're a cold climate area for grape, and I think that's what we get from this, is that kind of wonderful cold climate fruit that we get on European wines that we like or from Washington or in Oregon. But guess what? We can do it here, and we can do it really well.
So look in the mirror with pride and crack open a bottle of a Michigan wine, and you'll see what Chris is talking about. Chris Cook is always welcome on Stateside. We love talking wine with you, Chris, our Detroit Magazine's chief wine and restaurant critic. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Today's engineer was Rusty Brock. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Emily Fox, Sid Janwa, Joe Lindstroth, Jake Offenhartz, and Katrina Schaefer. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.